About 20 years ago, I think it was a Friday night. Yeah, it was a Friday night. Rav Amital spoke about Noach. Noach was an issue that he spoke about very often. Obviously, the dominant character of Parshas Noach, of the Mabel story, a very obscure figure, a peculiar figure, a multidimensional figure, and to a degree, a tragic figure. Heroic and tragic at the same time, obviously. And he began by citing the Medrash, and in each year, I hope each week to provide some Torah of the Rosh Hashiva on the Parsha, I won't constantly say he said and he said, I'll just introduce each year by the respective Rosh Hashiva author, and then I'll just deliver the shiur, and I'll just note when I'm adding something on my own, some elaboration. Rashi cites the Medrash, a very famous Medrash, Tzadik Tamim Haya B'der Azav. Some claim this is a praise for Noach, others see this as a backhanded insult, that he was only successful and only righteous when compared to his decadent generation. Others see this in many ways as an extrapolation or a hyperbole or an exaggeration, that if he could be a tzaddik in such a fallen generation, then you can imagine how righteous and how surpassing he may have been if he had an environmental support system. But either way, Noach is pitched very, very firmly within his generation. Either way you interpret the Medrash, the text itself hitches Noach to his generation. So there's a statement about Noach's, not just his own personal record and his own salvation, but what happened to the generation that Noach was part of. Now, this naturally, his proximity to Avraham, and Chazal elaborate the 10 generations which elapsed between Adam and Noach, and then subsequently the 10 generations which elapsed between Noach and Avram, or Avram. And it's clear that the end of Bereishis and the end of Noach provide textual parallels that direct our attention to this juxtaposition of Noach and Avram. And obviously Avram succeeds in manners and fashions that Noach doesn't. In many ways, what I said before captures the primary difference, that Noach was a man of his Dor HaSav. Avram was not. Avram was Avram Ivri. Avram traveled as a stranger from a strange land and inserted himself into a foreign culture, whereas Noach seems to have the pulse of his society. He's part of his generation, which in some ways would make his failure even more catastrophic. Because despite the fact that he was integrated culturally, he didn't have any impact on his generation. And this dichotomy or contrast between Noach and Avram is most graphic by comparing the section of stone with the section of the marble. In each case, in each instance, HaKadosh Baruch Hu informs each respective tzaddik of an impending tragedy, of an impending catastrophe, based on the criminal behavior of the world in the case of Noach and of the city of stone, or the metropolis of stone in the case of Avram. The response is, of course, very different. Noach dutifully and obediently fulfills Hashem's commandments and constructs a teva for his personal rescue, whereas Avram intercedes on behalf of Stone, ultimately unsuccessfully, but the effort is just very impressive, very audacious. He voices a comment which almost seems heretical, to challenge the divine will and the divine justice of Shafit Kol Aretz Lo Yasem Mishpat. So this subtle association and contrast becomes even more blatant when you compare these two sections. And the question is, what's at the core of the offset or the discrepancy between Noach and Avram? So the Zohar captures it. The Zohar claims that Noach was afraid that if he davened for his generation, he himself wouldn't be spared. It's a strange concept. Why would his davening prevent his rescue? So for Rav Amital, the solution rested in understanding the grounds of tefillah. To fully and authentically daven for someone, you have to really identify with their plight. Some people can't identify because they're insensitive, egotistical, self-centered. They can't share other people's pain. It reminds them of their own fragility. They're too obsessed with their own goals. Some people can't identify with others. Very often in today's world of mass media, mass communication, there are Tehillim lists and davening for people, which is certainly legitimate, and you can identify with people at different levels, but it certainly isn't equivalent to those that know the person and understand the pain that he and his or she and their family are experiencing and exposed to and daven appropriately. Noach was afraid of davening because daven would have to identify with them. Now, part of this is, and I don't think Rav Amital mentioned this then, I think he mentioned it on some other occasions, but it's certainly something that I picked up from him, maybe it was my own coloring of his statement, he had a hard time identifying with evil people, with corrupt people, with people who violated every decency and moral code, basic moral code. According to Chazal, they were violent, they abused one another, they cheated on each other's familial bonds, they worshipped idolatry. So the complete moral collapse created individuals that Noach had a hard time identifying with. The Zohar suggests that Noach was afraid that if he identified with them, he would convert into them, he would transform morally into a person. And either way, the challenge is for a person who strives to be a tzaddik and to become a righteous person to not abdicate the identification with those who aren't able to achieve similar achievements and similar religious goals and similar religious experiences. Now here is my own comment. Obviously Noach's situation was very stark. He was asked to pray and thereby identify with people who were corrupt and debased and degenerate at every level. But certainly over the last 200 years, the Jewish people has been faced with this challenge of trying to achieve personal piety without abdicating or forfeiting identification with those who are outside of the fold. However you describe the fold, whether they're no longer Orthodox in the classic sense, or they're not yeshiva, bachrim, people who are committed to Torah and Halach, however you define those different concentric circles of Jews, it's very hard to hybridize or harmonize the two. One could say that in very, very broad terminology, again, this is very broad, each yeshiva has its own approach, and different stages of history have witnessed different modulations. But in a general sense, without question, the price that the Ashkenazi world has paid for the yeshiva movement, and the yeshiva movement is primarily an Ashkenazi phenomena over the last 200 years, the price it's paid for the explosion of Torah and the ignition of Torah energy, the eruption of Torah energy, and the surpassing excellence in Torah that's been achieved, obviously, since the first yeshiva was constructed, first modern yeshiva in 1801, the Volozhin yeshiva, has been a culture of exclusion, a culture of exclusivity, both to people who aren't in the yeshiva world, the price that we pay for highlighting and celebrating the accomplishments of people that do learn Torah, sometimes, very often, we disparage, or at least there are disparaging trends towards those who don't study Torah, and certainly beyond that, to those who aren't religious in the classic sense, or don't perform mitzvahs. If you compare, so to speak, the yeshiva world, Ashkenazi yeshiva world, with the Sephardic world, which never benefited from the yeshiva movement, and that's why so much of the Torah energy in the Sephardic world has been fed by entering the Ashkenazi world of yeshivas, and that has led to a bit of a backlash in certain Sephardi circles. But the Sephardic culture still remains much more inclusive and much less disparaging and dismissive of those who aren't even close by any stretch to the Rishayim of Noach's generation, but aren't as religiously successful as the paradigm of the halachic paradigm, the Torah paradigm. Similarly, those who aren't inserted or embedded in the yeshiva world very often tend to be much more drawn to the national religious world in Israel, and that's part of this stark dichotomy, is that the national religious world has a place for non-Orthodox Jews, certainly in the state of Israel we do, serving in the army, becoming citizens of our state, contributing to the national Jewish trajectory. The yeshiva world clearly does not. It does have a messianic role. These aren't non-Jews, they're not meant to be abused or exploited or insulted, but there isn't an active interaction or an active role. And to a degree, on just a personal note, I grew up in the yeshiva world, and having attended a Hesder yeshiva, this is one of the very novel revolutionary ideas that struck me, is that after spending 12 years being schooled towards exclusivity, I sensed that there was an attempt to include a broader fabric of the Jewish people, and not just in theory, but in practice, and not just eschatologically delayed for the Messianic era. This is what makes Noach's failure so powerful in the modern context. And there's a continue, there's a ensuing Zohar, which makes us, excuse me, I just have a very bad sinus infection the last couple of days. What makes Noach's character so tragic is that he ultimately gets it. He ultimately understands the plight of others. As he exits the hermetic seal of his teva, of his ark, he surveys the destruction and the catastrophe, and he complains to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, is this your rachamim? At which point HaKadosh Baruch Hu chastises Noach. You had 120 years to importune and to requisition my rachamim, and now you ask me about my mercy? So it's even more tragic because Noach comes around and understands the need to sympathize with the plight of others, even evildoers and even the corrupt generation, but he understands it too late to save anyone, whereas, of course, Avram struggles, attempts, though he doesn't save stone, he obviously is capable of saving, either physically or spiritually, many, many other people of his generation. Now, the second part of the Sicha was really about defining the Dor HaMabul. We see their behavior on display, but how did they descend into such corrupt behavior? What was the cause? What was the primary cause? So there's an interesting Gemara in Sanhedrin, commented on by Tzedek HaKohen Lublin. The Gemara in Sanhedrin attributes their moral demise to the prosperity that Hashem bestowed them with. Lo nisga'u ela b'shvil tova shehishpia lehem HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And this correlates with a medrash that describes the generation of the Dor HaMabul as possessing supernatural command over their environment. Young children, a few days old, would walk the earth and bestride the earth and snap big cedar trees like toothpicks, and they would plant once every 40 years, and that would be sufficient to sustain them. They were living in this transition stage between the unlimited natural potential and the unlimited human potential in Gan Eden, which was forfeited by the successive sins of Adam and Cain, and the pre-Mabul world of the children of God who fall from heaven. It was still very supernatural and very metaphysical and celestial, as opposed to the post-Mabul world, which is very, very terrestrial. So they had tremendous prosperity. And the Gemara can quotes a series of psukim from Eov. So obviously there's a theological challenge to prosperity, which Eov fingers, and the final pasuk, which the Gemara quotes, having described their prosperity, which is taken from Eov, Perech Chafalef, Lakel, Vayomu Lakel, they told Hashem, Sur Mimenu, step aside, V'das Derechecha, Lachafasnu, we're not interested in understanding your ways, Kinavdenu, Umano Il, Mashakai Kinavdenu, what is God that we should worship him? Umano Il Kinifkabo, how will it be beneficial to us if we encounter him? So this is the pasuk which the Gemara describes as the consequence of their material benefit. Now the literal translation of the Gemara, the literal interpretation, is that they became haughty and cocky because of their success. But Tzedek HaKohen Lublin comments that their success provided too much leisure time. They didn't have to work that hard, and perhaps hundreds of years of success had softened the curse of Adam and Cain, the Kotz V'Dardar Tatznech Lach Navanad, and we see this in the end of Bereishis, developing cattle and herds and shepherding and tools of iron, and there is a bit of an industrial thrust that happens or that occurs, that unfolds between the condemnation of Cain and the progression of humanity. And they were unreachable, because they lived in a culture of abundance and a culture of leisure time. And that culture of abundance and leisure time muted any spiritual aspiration. That's a very resonant comment for the 20th and 21st century. How does the abundance of leisure time dull religious aspiration, religious ambition? On the one hand, it can afford great opportunity for religious growth and freed of the challenges of menial labor, of suffering natural disasters, of being shackled to the the agricultural challenge, we can dedicate massive energy and resources to spiritual interests. On the other hand, it can create a culture of leisure, a culture of laziness, a culture of entertainment, a culture of distraction, a culture of... those are just questions of time management. There are deeper cultural messages which leisure celebrates, which even in the absence of compromised time management can be very, very toxic to Torah-centric values. It's something which I think is obvious to most people. I don't have to elaborate upon those dual challenges, A, time management, B, just the system of values that the culture of leisure provides. So it's a very different read on Noach than simply probing their corrupt behavior, their criminal activity. It's questioning the root, and the Gemara and Sanhedrin attributes it in Daf Kuf Ches to their prosperity, but Tzedek HaKohen retraced it to the leisure culture, the culture of leisure that prosperity had yielded.